everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, Leah Hazard delivers the truth about being a midwife with her new book, Hard Pushed.
The book is my story of my journey to being a midwife, and hopefully will explain to the public a bit more about what the midwife's role actually is in today's NHS.
Connect Radio's Stephen Scott introduces us to the latest tech for listening to books and tells us what he's been reading.
It just meant that it was a really difficult thing to use, to navigate, to find what I was looking for. Once you found it, it was great, but it just seemed like a bit of a journey to get to the book you wanted.
And I review a dystopian classic written by an author better known for her detective fiction. That's all coming up in today's Read On. First up, Robert Kirkwood talks to Leah Hazard. And please note that this interview contains the odd word or phrase not suitable for family listening.
No sleep for 20 hours, no food for 10, and a ward full of soon-to-be mothers. Welcome to the life of a midwife. Life on the NHS front line, working within a system at breaking point, is more extreme than you could ever imagine. From the bloody to the beautiful, from moments of utter vulnerability to remarkable displays of strength, from camaraderie to raw desperation, from heart-wrenching grief to the pure, perfect joy of a newborn baby. Midwife Leah Hazard has seen it all, and she documents it in her memoir, Hard Pushed. She recorded the audio version at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow, and be warned, it hits the ground running.
Another night, another vagina. It's not unusual for me to spend the night between a stranger's legs. Sometimes two or three strangers in the space of 12 hours. Tonight is a bit different, though. It's 3:42 a.m. and things aren't going to plan. Sitting in point-blank range of this particular vagina feels like staring down the barrel of a gun. Birth is inherently risky, a kind of physiological Russian roulette, but every midwife prays that she'll dodge the bullet. "I can't do it," wails a disembodied voice. At the same time, a slick patch of dark hair looms into view in front of me. "You are doing it, and you will do it," I call up to the voice. I glance quickly at the clock on the wall and then say quietly to myself, 0344, vertex visible. I will need to write a detailed report of all of these times and events later, when the blood-stained paper drapes have been bagged and tagged, a tray of tea and biscuits sits on the windowsill, and the baby has arrived safely. If the baby arrives safely.
Leah Hazard, reading from her memoir Hard Pushed. After the recording, I joined her in the studio.
The book is my story of my journey to being a midwife, and hopefully will explain to the public a bit more about what the midwife's role actually is in today's NHS and correct some of the misperceptions about what it is that we do and don't do. The hardest thing about writing the book was doing justice to the stories of the women that I've looked after. Ideally, they would be able to tell their amazing stories themselves. So I felt like to tell some of these stories that demonstrated their strength and their vulnerability, I really needed to honour their experience and tell these stories as accurately as I could without obviously compromising anybody's privacy.
Now, you're from America, you studied at Harvard. How did you find yourself within NHS Scotland?
So it's a good question. So the first time I came to Scotland was just travelling through, and I had a great time and I wanted to come back, as so many people do. And then I returned properly to start a master's degree in directing, actually, at the RSAMD, which is now the Conservatoire. And I went out to the dancing 2 weeks after I came over, and I met my husband and I stayed. So that was almost 20 years ago.
As someone who's experienced both, what are the major and the obvious differences between the US and the UK health system?
Well, that's enough for a whole other radio show. And I'm not maybe the best person to comment, because I've lived my adult life and only ever worked as a midwife within this healthcare system. But there are obviously vast differences, the main one being money. Here, obviously, the NHS is free at the point of service to anybody who needs it, especially in acute emergency situations. So we never ask anybody when they come in to triage, do you have insurance, or where are you from? How long have you been in this country? And that doesn't influence our care. And also in terms of the role of the midwife, it doesn't really exist in America in the same way it does here. There are registered midwives and registered nurse midwives, labour and delivery nurses, as they're sometimes called. But the role here is really special in that it's really autonomous. And we are trained really to be the leaders in normal pregnancy and birth, and to coordinate a woman's care, and to plan and implement our own plans of care in coordination and in team working with doctors, but quite often on our own. So it's quite a special role here.
And you were a doula before becoming a midwife. What does that involve?
Yeah, it's not something that a lot of people here are really familiar with, and it wasn't really something that I knew about until I started looking into maybe ways of retraining and different ways to go. So a doula is really just a lay supporter. It's somebody who can give emotional and practical support to women in pregnancy and the postnatal period, but it doesn't have any clinical element whatsoever. It's not about telling the woman what to do. It's not about providing any clinical care. It's really just, in some ways, a very traditional role of care and support. My first experience with midwifery was as a mother when I was pregnant and had my first daughter many years ago now. And I respected the role. I don't think I really completely understood the pressures of the women who were looking after me and the numerous skills that they had and could use. But I think that it's very difficult to understand the role unless you actually undertake that training and start living that reality, or read my book, of course. But I think the role is much more complex and challenging and more highly skilled than most people realise.
It's a noisy job too.
Mums and babies can make a lot of noise, and midwives can make a lot of noise as well. We try and keep things peaceful and calm, obviously, for the women we're looking after, but it's not always possible, especially in really busy urban maternity units like the one I work in. I work in a very busy hospital, and it's very difficult to give that sense of kind of sanctuary and calm sometimes. So yes, it's noisy for us as well.
Notes on children having children. Lock her up. It's the only contraception you can trust. This was the advice ruefully given to me by Bridget, a woman whose 15-year-old daughter Shannon had just arrived at the hospital in early labour. I knelt by the bed and watched Shannon writhe with the fresh horror of each contraction as it rippled through her size zero frame, every surge seeming to catch her by surprise. Could this one possibly hurt as much as the last? Her face seemed to say. Will it ever stop? Yes, was the answer, and also, blessedly, yes. Her labour was fast, as often seems to be the case for the youngest mothers, and 2 hours later she gave birth to her own little girl, clutching Bridget's hand the whole time, and crying for her mum even as the baby latched onto her breast. Many reports in recent years have highlighted the increasing number of older women having babies. Elderly primogravidas, as medics cruelly used to call them, conjuring images of fetuses springing forth from dusty, wrinkled wombs. Although there's no denying that the average age of the pregnant population is climbing slowly skywards, there are also still thousands of women giving birth every year who are, well, children. Some, like Shannon, conceive after only their second or third fumbling attempt at sex. Others, Shannon's age or younger, make up a small but growing group whose bulging bellies are the byproducts of trafficking and abuse.
So this chapter is about a kind of composite character based on numerous experiences I've had. Her name is Crystal, and she's 15, and she's about to give birth to a very preterm baby. And it throws up all kinds of challenges and questions about how you look after these young women or children who are themselves really vulnerable. You have to wonder how they came to be pregnant, or, you know, what the relationships are that led them to that place. And it's challenging, and at times when you look after somebody really young, it can be very rewarding because in some ways they're in particular need of your care and your comfort. But it's a really difficult one. And so I tried to address that in the book. And it's in some ways one that's quite close to my heart as well, because as I write in the book, I have two girls who are in or entering their teenage years. And I've recently found myself in the really strange position of looking after and having to examine young girls who look very similar to my own children. And it's a really tricky one to do with the right balance of sensitivity and skill.
Whatever the context, looking after such young women has always struck me as a unique challenge. On the one hand, as the mother of two girls, teenagers send my protective impulses into overdrive, and my urge to shield them from pain, upset, and the multiple cruelties that the world inflicts on women becomes almost irrationally strong, even if some of these girls are already more streetwise and battle-hardened than I will ever be. On the other hand, the very examinations and procedures that I need to perform in order to do my job can become deeply uncomfortable where young girls are involved. How do you explain a vaginal examination to a 14-year-old who's never had a smear test or more than a handful of periods, and who's certainly never been touched down there by someone she could trust? Does it feel right to inject pain-relieving diamorphine, which, to be blunt, is simply medical-grade heroin, into the skinny thigh of a teenager whose body is the same size and shape as your child's, even if she's begging and screaming for you to just give me the jag already? When children have children, the midwife needs to ask herself 100 tricky questions, and even after countless Shannons, there are no easy answers.
Now, you've narrated the book yourself. How was that process?
I enjoyed it, but it was quite intense. When I was writing the book, I tended to only really spend maximum a condensed period of 2 or 3 hours writing. I've never written fiction, but particularly writing your own memoir, and particularly when you're writing about things that are maybe not always your proudest moments or your happiest moments, it's quite intense to spend more than a few hours reliving that and retelling that. So spending the last 2 full days reading my own thoughts out loud has been, it's been quite intense, but I've enjoyed it. In a sense, it's the first time I've really read and listened to the whole arc of the book in its entirety in quite a long time. So I hope that the readers will enjoy that as well.
Now, as you've said, it's a very, very intense job. And I know that sometimes medical people are possibly the worst at looking after themselves. So what do you do to relax and unwind and get away from it?
That's a good question. And it is really important for anybody in the kind of caring professions to know how to look after themselves and to care for themselves. And it's something that I'm still learning about. At home with my family is really the best place for me to feel kind of safe and cared for. But actually last year, when I was actually writing the book, I was doing a lot of running. And it wasn't something that I really planned. I'd made what in retrospect was quite a foolish promise to run 3 half marathons in the year for SANS, which is a stillbirth and neonatal death charity. So I'd made this pledge and this commitment before I'd even come up with the idea for the book or sold the book or had to start writing the book. And in some ways it was really difficult to kind of do the training and put in the time for the running as well as doing the book. But in retrospect, it was really good for my mental health because it meant that I had these kind of prolonged, enforced periods of kind of quiet time and quiet kind of meditative thought to think about things that had happened at work and also to kind of write quite a lot of the book in my head as I was doing these runs. So I've been quite lazy over the winter since I finished the book, but I still find running a really good form of kind of mental health and release.
Tick, tick, tick. Tick, tick. Mary and I tense in unison as the monitor picking up the baby's heartbeat slows, becoming irregular, sounding a familiar warning. 0349, audible deceleration to 96 beats per minute. This is the drum roll we dread. "Your baby's getting a bit tired," I say cautiously to the woman on the bed.
That makes two of us, retorts the voice, ragged and weary now.
Lee Hazard, reading from her memoir, Hard Pushed. And Lee, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here. Enjoy the book.
Thanks to Robert and Leah Hazard. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, I review a dystopian thriller written by an author better known for her crime novels. And another crime writer, Ian Skewis, shares the books of his life. But first, as regular listeners will know, Stephen Scott presents our sister show, Tech Talk, bringing us all the latest news in technology for blind people. When he's not unravelling the complexities of the computer age for us, he's usually got his ears wrapped around a good audiobook. So I wanted to find out what's new on both fronts. So, Stephen, you've been busily listening to some audiobooks for us, have you?
Well, I have. And you know, it's really interesting, Red, because first of all, it's lovely to be back on the show. Thank you for inviting me, because I do enjoy Read On. And it is interesting because for the past few years, I've probably not been listening to as many audiobooks, not so much as I should have, but I don't think I've really been enjoying the spoils of talking books as much. I don't know why necessarily. I think I've often come up with lots of excuses as to why, like I don't have enough time or who's got 12 hours to listen to a book kind of thing. But truth be told, once you start getting into it, you realise that time, it can be used in so many different ways, on public transport or if you're sitting on a long train journey or you just are at home and you can't sleep, just listening to a great book can help you. So yeah, I am back into talking books in a big way at the moment.
And how are you listening to them?
Well, this might not be popular with Read On, or indeed RNIB, but I am a bit of an Audible fan.
It's all right, you're allowed.
Well, you know, I got into Audible partly because I just really struggled with the RNIB Overdrive app. And although the Overdrive app isn't actually made by RNIB, it's a third party, and RNIB have sort of contracted Overdrive, the company, to take care of the RNIB Talking Book service. It just meant that it was a really difficult thing to use, to navigate, to find what I was looking for. Once you found it, it was great, but it just seemed like a bit of a journey to get to the book you wanted. And for that reason, I have to be honest, we're consumers. You know, yeah, we are blind. And yeah, of course, we're very grateful of the wonderful work that is done by RNIB and Talking Books service. But if it's easier to use another service to listen to your books, then that's what I'm going to do, because I don't have all the time in the world to try and figure these things out. So for that reason, I signed up to Audible and I've been building up my credits, although it rather annoyed me because I've got 6 credits remaining, and apparently you don't get any more than 6 at a time. So I'm having to go off and get books, as I've been doing actually. I've been going and getting lots and lots of books into my Audible library. But I do want to talk a bit about the app that came out just at the tail end of last year as well, because it really deserves a mention, and that is the Dolphin Easy Reader app, which is for iPhones and Android devices. And it also lets you use RNIB Overdrive, but it does it in a much better way. So you can use the RNIB Talking Book service through the Easy Reader app. All you do is sign in with your library card number and PIN, and that's it. You've got access to it. And I have to say, it's a much easier, much cleaner layout on the app. It's not perfect, but I don't think any app really is, truthfully, if you use a glass surface to navigate. So I am finding Dolphin Easy Reader great, and it is getting me back into the RNIB Overdrive, RNIB Talking Books service again.
Well, that's great. You, like me, have failing sight. And I think, like you, I have struggled for quite a few years now trying to find very small icons on Overdrive. And Easy Reader seems to have been designed with those of us who are losing our sight in mind. It's a lot more bold colours on bold backgrounds. And as you say, it's a lot cleaner and easier to use. I think you're now using it purely on voiceover, text-to-speech. How's it work as far as that's concerned?
Well, Dolphin Easy Reader is fabulous, and the Audible app is really good as well. So both are really good. And I think it's important we discuss options like that, because there are times that books will come out and technology will mean that, you know, if an audiobook appears in Audible and the technology is accessible to us, we're going to use it, aren't we? So I think we should be all able to use all of these different services. I'd hate to get to the point, and I know RNIB don't believe this and wouldn't believe this, but I wouldn't like to get to a point where it was like, okay, so this is your service. This is for you, and you can't use anything else. Because I have had people who work in the Talking Book service kind of joke around and say, ah, you know, you've got the Talking Book service, what do you want Audible for? And I kind of laugh along, but I also say, well, partly because if you wanted to watch a TV show on Netflix and then another show on Amazon Prime, no one's going to chap your door and say, hey, why are you watching Amazon Prime? You've paid for Netflix. You can watch what you want. You can do what you want.
Yeah, it's the supermarket thing, isn't it? Sainsbury's sausages will taste better than Tesco's sausages. But then again, I like getting other stuff from Tesco's. So
exactly.
And are you still listening to books at all with your MP3 player, your little portable? I think it was a Sovereign, wasn't it?
The Sovereign, yeah. Do you know, I haven't for a long time. I've kind of given everything over to the phone. So I'm using an iPhone to listen to my books on Audible and also on Easy Reader with Overdrive. So yeah, that's how I'm kind of doing it at the moment. And it works really well.
It's more precise navigating on Easy Reader than it is going back an entire chapter on the MP3 yeah. player, isn't it? So tell us what you've been listening to recently then.
I am a huge American politics fan. I'm probably one of the few people who watches CNN whilst eating popcorn. I really, really enjoy American politics, especially at the moment. I mean, we all know the world is going to hell in a handcart, but at least it's an enjoyable watch. And I am really interested in what's going on with Trump and the White House and all the rest. So a number of the books I've been buying recently have been around that. The one I've been reading up until recently was Fear, Trump and the White House. That was by Bob Woodward, which was his big book. This was a guy who had also written a lot of exposés and done a lot of investigation work before.
He worked on Watergate, didn't he?
He did, yeah. A very prominent journalist on that. And this guy knows what he's talking about. So it was interesting to hear his viewpoint.
Despite almost daily reports of chaos and discord in the White House, the public did not know how bad the internal situation actually was. Trump was always shifting, rarely fixed, erratic. He would get in a bad mood, something large or small would infuriate him, and he would say about the Chorus trade agreement, "We're withdrawing today." But now there was the letter, dated September 5th, 2017, a potential trigger to a national security catastrophe. Cohn was worried Trump would sign the letter if he saw it. Cohn removed the letter draft from the Resolute desk. He placed it in a blue folder marked Keep. "I stole it off his desk," he later told an associate. "I wouldn't let him see it. He's never going to see that document. Got to protect the country." In the anarchy and disorder of the White House and Trump's mind, the president never noticed the missing letter. Ordinarily, Rob Porter, the staff secretary and organizer of presidential paperwork, would have been responsible for producing letters like this to the South Korean president. But this time, alarmingly, the letter draft had come to Trump through an unknown channel. Staff secretary is one of the low-profile but critical roles in any White House. For months, Porter had been briefing Trump on decision memos and other presidential documents, including the most sensitive national security authorizations for military and covert CIA activities.
Robert Petkoff narrating Fear, Trump in the White House, written by Bob Woodward and available via Audible. It's also out in print and ebook.
Cliff Sims was a guy that I heard about from one of the American political talk shows. And this was a guy who had actually worked in the White House. I wouldn't say at a particularly senior level, but because of the chaotic nature of the White House at the moment, he was able to be part of conversations that perhaps he shouldn't have been part of, meetings he shouldn't have been in. But he decided when he left, and I've not got to the bit yet to decide whether or not he's left or he's been fired. I imagine fired, and if not, certainly he will have been now. But this guy wrote a book called Team of Vipers, which kind of says it all, really. He talks about his experience of getting into the campaign, early days, and then leading up to the point where he left the administration. And it's a really, really interesting book. But of course, I'm trying to be positive these days, not just look at the disaster that is the world around us. So there's a series of books that I always wanted. And actually, funnily enough, last week, I was thinking about these books because a dear friend of mine died recently. And one of the things he gave me in life, he gave me two things in life, this friend of mine. And that was country music, which I maybe shouldn't thank him for, but I do. and books, certain books called Chicken Soup for the Soul. Now, I'm not a hippie by any stretch of the imagination, and anyone who knows me will know that, but I do love hearing positive stories. You know, sometimes you can just hear a bit too much negativity. And I think it's partly driven by the fact I spent about 11 years of my career working in news. And when you work in news for long enough, you can get very depressed, right? It's just, it's not positive stuff that's going on. And sometimes you just want to drift away from that and get away from it. And that was why I get into Chicken Soup for the Soul stories, because all the books are built for different groups of people. So it could be for new mums, it could be for teenagers, it could be for whoever. But they do have collections, just generally nice stories, and they're usually quite short stories. And so I've used my Audible credits for a bunch of Chicken Soup for the Soul books.
Les Brown and his twin brother were adopted by Mamie Brown, a kitchen worker and maid, shortly after their birth in a poverty-stricken Miami neighborhood. Because of his hyperactivity and nonstop jabber, Les was placed in special education classes for the learning disabled in grade school and throughout high school. Upon graduation, he became a city sanitation worker in Miami Beach. But he had a dream of being a disc jockey. At night, he would take a transistor radio to bed, where he listened to the local jive-talking DJs. He created an imaginary radio station in his tiny room with its torn vinyl flooring. A hairbrush served as his microphone as he practiced his patter, introducing records to his ghost listeners. His mother and brother could hear him through the thin walls and would shout at him to quit flapping his jaws and go to sleep. But Les didn't listen to them. He was wrapped up in his own world, living a dream. One day, Les boldly went to the local radio station during his lunch break from mowing grass for the city. He got into the station manager's office and told him he wanted to be a disc jockey. The manager eyed this disheveled young man in overalls and a straw hat and inquired, "Do you have any background in broadcasting?" Les replied, "No, sir, I don't." "Well, son, I'm afraid we don't have a job for you then." Les thanked him politely and left. The station manager assumed that he had seen the last of this young man, but he underestimated the depth of Les Brown's commitment to his goal. You see, Les had a higher purpose than simply wanting to be a disc jockey. He wanted to buy a nicer house for his adoptive mother, whom he loved deeply. The disc jockey job was merely a step toward his goal. Mamie Brown had taught Les to pursue his dream, so he felt sure that he would get a job at the radio station in spite of what the station manager had said. And so Les returned to the station every day for a week, asking if there were any job openings. Finally, the station manager gave in and took him on as an errand boy, at no pay. At first, he fetched coffee or picked up lunches and dinner for the DJs, who could not leave the studio. Eventually, his enthusiasm for their work won him the confidence of the disc jockeys, who would send him in their Cadillacs to pick up visiting celebrities such as The Temptations and Diana Ross and The Supremes. Little did any of them know that young Les did not even have a driver's license.
A special 20th anniversary edition of Chicken Soup for the Soul, containing dozens of stories to lift up your spirits, is available from Amazon in a full range of formats, including this audiobook.
And of course, again, political, Michelle Obama's book, Becoming Michelle Obama, narrated by her, actually, which is really nice. That is another one which I'm enjoying at the minute.
I spent much of my childhood listening to the sound of striving. It came in the form of bad music, or at least amateur music, coming up through the floorboards of my bedroom, the plink, plink, plink of students sitting downstairs at my great Aunt Robbie's piano, slowly and imperfectly learning their scales. My family lived in the South Shore neighborhood of Chicago, in a tidy brick bungalow that belonged to Robbie and her husband Terry. My parents rented an apartment on the second floor, while Robbie and Terry lived on the first. Robbie was my mother's aunt and had been generous to her over many years. But to me, she was kind of a terror. Prim and serious, she directed the choir at a local church and was also our community's resident piano teacher. She wore sensible heels and kept a pair of reading glasses on a chain around her neck. She had a sly smile, but didn't appreciate sarcasm the way my mother did. I'd sometimes hear her chewing out her students for not having practiced enough, or chewing out their parents for delivering them late to lessons. "Good night," she'd exclaim in the middle of the day, with the same blast of exasperation someone else would say, "Oh, for God's sake." Few, it seemed, could live up to Robbie's standards.
Michelle Obama narrating her autobiography, Becoming, which is out now commercially and on its way to the RNIB library soon.
So there are absolutely tons. I mean, I've also downloaded Rules of Seeing by Joe Heap.
Yes, we featured that on Read On.
Exactly, and that's why I decided to download that to listen. And The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, which is, we'll not go there, but...
Thought-provoking, I think, is the
word.
Well,
that's it. Yeah, exactly. I like things that pique my interest in new areas and take me away from my own thoughts, give me new ideas. I like to sort of sometimes look outside the bubble a bit. But yeah, there's some really interesting reads, and I think I'm starting to enjoy reading through listening, granted, a lot more these days because of that. So that's what's on the bookshelf at the minute.
It's funny you should say about reading through listening. I remember talking to Verity Smith, the blind equestrian champion, and she said that when she learnt as a child to read through listening rather than with her eyes, it was like learning to write with her left hand rather than her right hand. But after enough practice, it becomes second nature.
It is interesting because a friend of mine actually said to me just recently, we were talking about listening to books rather than reading them. And she had mentioned to me that for a long time, like me, she would put off trying to listen to audiobooks. She just wished she could read them because she wanted all the stories to be in her head, how she would imagine it rather than the way it's being told to her, which does give a character to the story that you might not have gotten had you read it on paper. And she said the way I got round that was by imagining, she said, one of the things I loved when I was young was my dad reading stories to me as a child. And she said, and I kind of had to think back to why I loved that so much and then apply that thought to this. And she said, for that reason, now I enjoy books more because I think about them differently. I think about them like my dad sitting down reading books to me as a child. And she said, and that's kind of where I get the enjoyment again from. So I think that's a really nice way of looking at it, actually.
Yeah, it's a lovely way of looking at it. And storytelling is an oral tradition. People were telling stories before they were writing them down. I also have found out from an awful lot of the authors I talk to that they do now read back to themselves what they've written, knowing that it's going to be made into an audiobook. And I wonder if possibly the way people write is changing more back to that oral tradition.
I'm glad that authors think that way. But I often think that's partly because of the commercial aspect of audiobooks. Now, that's not a bad thing, because I've said for years on Tech Talk and I've said it on my shows that what I want to see is a world that thinks mainstream, but with accessibility built in from the ground up. Now, in audiobooks, let's not think about audiobooks as for blind people, but for everybody. That's how you change things. That's how you get accessibility into the mainstream. Because if you have an audiobook that you can listen to at the gym or on the way to work, you want to catch up on a book. I mean, I think about it now. If I could drive, my journey in the morning is about 40 minutes. You know, I get a good couple of chapters in there. And that would be great. Now, I can do that, of course, with my headphones on in a car or on a train or whatever. But if you're driving and you can do that, then that's brilliant that you can expand your knowledge and expand your awareness of things by listening to books in that way. That gets it into the mainstream so that we get away from this nonsense of, well, you know, it can't be an audiobook because the blind charity hasn't gone out and made it yet. Stuff that. Let's get it into the mainstream. And I think Audible is one company that's kind of broken through and got that. And we maybe don't see it that way because we've been wrapped up in the world of RNIB talking books and the wonderful service that it is. And I would never take away from the wonderful work. I know a lot of the people who work there. And it's a brilliant service. The work that goes into it is incredible. And we should never lose sight of that. But we also shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we want the world to be accessible to as many people as possible. And to do that, you've got to bring people in. We can't create an exclusive world just for blind people that's got all the bits we want. It has to be accessible to everybody, whether it be large text on a phone. You can increase the text size on your phone. Now, that's great for visually impaired people, but actually, that's also great for someone who's just having a bit of difficulty seeing the text. That's how you change it. That's how you break that barrier down between accessibility and mainstream, I think.
Yeah, it's about sharing what we've learned rather than keeping it to ourselves and, as you say, feeding it into the mainstream. Well, certainly I know that a lot of commercial audiobooks are being recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios, so there's cross-fertilisation there. But yes, I believe it's never been such an exciting time to work with audiobooks as it is now, and the more books that are published in audio, the better for all of us.
Couldn't agree more. It's an exciting time. I've heard people say it's an exciting time to be blind. I'm not sure if I agree with that sentiment.
Yeah.
But I do understand what people mean by that. I wouldn't say it's great to be blind right now, but I suppose if there was a time in history, this would probably be it, because the accessibility of our world is far greater now than it was. As I said at the start, it's like the Dolphin Easy Reader app versus Overdrive. It's not perfect, but it's better. At least it's there.
It's heading in the right direction. At least they're asking the likes of you and me for our input rather than superimposing a sighted person's solution for what their view of sight loss is.
Absolutely.
Well, Stephen, we can find out more about the exciting developments in technology by listening to your show each week. What time do you broadcast and how do we access the podcast?
Okay, so we've had a bit of a change at Tech Talk. So our regular guys, Tim and Sean, are away. They've gone off to explore new pastures, and I wish them all the best, although they will be back from time to time. They're not disappearing completely, but they won't be on the weekly show. So we've got new hosts starting. Robin Christofferson is going to be joining the show from AbilityNet, which is brilliant news, and we're really excited about it. The show is going to take a slightly different direction in that we want to tell the good news stories about what RNIB is up to. RNIB does lots of great things, and I've been learning so much about these things. I think it's important the world knows about them. So that's going to be part of the new show as we move forward, and we welcome everyone's input on that, of course. But we will be talking truthfully, honestly about tech, as we always do. So we encourage people to listen and share their thoughts and views, and agreement and disagreement is always part of our show. That is absolutely the case. So it continues, of course, Tuesdays at 1. That does not change. It's also repeated at various points during the week as well. But Tuesday at 1 is when the show is broadcast first. And the podcast is available at exactly the same time on Apple Podcasts and Google Play Podcasts.
Well, keep up the good work and happy reading. And thank you very much for sharing your insights with the Read On listeners.
Thanks for having me back, Red.
Thanks again to Stephen Scott. And don't forget that, as with Read On, you can download the Tech Talk podcast each week. Just follow the link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, so you need never miss an episode of either show. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, we'll discover which titles crime writer Ian Skewis has chosen as the books of his life. But first, P.D. James was best known as a crime writer. Many of her best-selling novels, including Death of an Expert Witness and Devices and Desires, feature Inspector Adam Dalgleish, a meticulous policeman with a tragic past and a flair for poetry. But for her 1992 novel, The Children of Men, she set Dalgleish and crime aside to venture into a dystopian future that, back then, must still have felt reassuringly far off. The year is 2021 and the human race is dying out. Since 1995, year Omega, no babies have been born anywhere in the world due to global male infertility. The dwindling and aging population has lost faith in science and religion and faces extinction without hope.
We are outraged and demoralized less by the impending end of our species, less even by our inability to prevent it, than by our failure to discover the cause. Western science and Western medicine haven't prepared us for the magnitude and humiliation of this ultimate failure. There have been many diseases which have been difficult to diagnose or cure, and one which almost depopulated two continents before it spent itself. But we have always, in the end, been able to explain why. We have given names to the viruses and germs which, even today, take possession of us, much to our chagrin, since it seems a personal affront that they should still assail us, like old enemies who keep up the skirmish and bring down the occasional victim when their victory is assured. Western science has been our god. In the variety of its power, it has preserved, comforted, healed, warmed, fed, and entertained us, and we have felt free to criticize and occasionally reject it, as men have always rejected their gods, but in the knowledge that despite our apostasy, this deity, our creature and our slave, would still provide for us. The anesthetic for the pain, the spare heart, the new lung, the antibiotic, the moving wheels, and the moving pictures. The light will always come on when we press the switch, and if it doesn't, we can find out why. Science was never a subject I was at home with. I understood little of it at school, and I understand little more now that I'm 50. Yet it has been my god, too, even if its achievements are incomprehensible to me. And I share the universal disillusionment of those whose god has died. I can clearly remember the confident words of one biologist spoken when it had finally become apparent that nowhere in the whole world was there a pregnant woman. It may take us some time to discover the cause of this apparent universal infertility. We have had 25 years, and we no longer even expect to succeed.
England is ruled by a dictatorial warden and the state police. Even petty crime is punishable by deportation to a penal colony on the Isle of Man. With no future to work towards, most people, including the book's protagonist, Theo Farron, are content just to make themselves as comfortable as possible in the present. They live on a diet of mushy nostalgia that includes endless reruns of children's shows and Neighbours. All the menial tasks necessary to keep the country running are performed by sojourners, immigrants imported from poorer countries, who are forcibly repatriated once they become unfit to work. England's own sick and elderly are disposed of at mass suicide events, while the Omegas, the last generation to have been born, are both revered and feared. Answerable to no one, they express their frustration and impotence in acts of cruelty and destruction. Theo is the warden's cousin and, until he became disillusioned, was his chief advisor. A history professor at Oxford, he's now content to teach bored, middle-aged students because there's no one under the age of 25 anymore. Here he meets Julian, a 30-something woman who is part of a small quasi-Christian group called the Five Fishes, who are agitating for better human rights. They want the sojourners to be allowed to remain in the country when they get too old to work, and an end to the brutal man penal colony. Theo is attracted to Julian, and she in turn persuades him to appeal to the warden on behalf of the Five Fishes.
Theo asked himself how many of the other reforms he might have achieved had he stayed as Zan's advisor, but he knew the answer. He had been powerless then, and the Five Fishes were powerless now. If there had been no Omega, these were aims which a man might be prepared to fight for, even to suffer for. But if there had been no Omega, the evils would not exist. It was reasonable to suffer, to struggle, perhaps even to die for a more just, a more compassionate society, but not in a world with no future where, all too soon, the very words justice, compassion, society, struggle, evil would be unheard echoes on an empty air. Julian would say that it was worth the struggle and the suffering to save even one sojourner from ill treatment or prevent even one offender from being deported to the man penal colony. But whatever the Five Fishes did, that wouldn't happen. It wasn't within their power. Rereading the Five Demands, he felt a draining away of his initial sympathy. He told himself that most men and women, human mules deprived of posterity, yet carried their burden of sorrow and regret with such fortitude as they could muster, contrived their compensating pleasures, indulged small personal vanities, behaved with decency to each other and to such sojourners as they met. By what right did the Five Fishes seek to impose upon these stoical dispossessed the futile burden of heroic virtue? He took the paper into the lavatory and after tearing it precisely into quarters, flushed them down the bowl. As they were sucked, swirling out of sight, he wished for a second, no more, that he could share the passion and the folly which bound together that pitiably unarmored fellowship.
He fails, and, being as passively pessimistic about the future as pretty much everyone else, he's prepared to give up. However, he can't get his feelings for Julianne or the revulsion he felt for the brutality that he witnessed at one of the mass suicides out of his head. So, when one of the five fishes is captured, putting Julianne's life in danger, he helps her and the others go on the run. What follows is a fairly standard fugitive chase across the south of England that had me turning the pages as eagerly as any John Wyndham or Alistair MacLean thriller, and it has a satisfying and not wholly predictable ending. But it's the scene setting of the first half of the book that I found enthralling. Most dystopian novels are built around an apocalypse, but by removing the hope for the future that children represent, P.D. James shows humanity in a particularly bleak light. In their desperation for children, some women become mothers to dolls, while others hold kitten christenings. The younger men become feral, the middle-aged obsessed by power, and the old are driven to despair and suicide. It's by turns heartbreaking and chilling, and it means that when an element of hope is introduced into the plot, its fragility and beauty is all the more moving. Ultimately, like any good dystopian novel, The Children of Men holds a mirror up to contemporary society, and since it was written in the early 1990s, it does feel a little dated in places. That said, many of the issues it raises, such as caring for an ageing population and the use of migrant labour from poorer countries, are even more pertinent today than they were 25 years ago. As is the question at the heart of the book, what kind of world will we leave behind us?
Early this morning, the 1st of January 2021, 3 minutes after midnight, the last human being to be born on Earth was killed in a pub brawl in a suburb of Buenos Aires, aged 25 years, 2 months, and 12 days. If the first reports are to be believed, Joseph Ricardo died as he had lived. The distinction, if one can call it that, of being the last human whose birth was officially recorded, unrelated as it was to any personal virtue or talent, had always been difficult for him to handle. And now he is dead.
The Children of Men by P.D. James is available from the RNIB Library in Braille and as TB9673. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Murder of Crows is a tense psychological thriller by debut author Ian Skewis. Originally published in print and ebook, an audio version has recently been recorded, and Ian Skewis joined Robert Kirkwood in our Glasgow studio to share the books of his life.
Ian, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
The earliest book I remember reading, and it's still one that I've got a lot of fondness for, was The Treasure Hunters by Enid Blyton, and it was my grandmother that bought me this little hardback book. It had a yellow spine and a paper outside cover, and I just loved it because it was about these children who find this treasure. If memory serves correctly, it's outdoors, but it's in an old hut or house, if I remember right, and I loved it. It was a really magical story, and it kind of reminds me of being, you know, playing outdoors in the countryside myself. So that would that's still one that I have a lot of fondness for from my childhood.
The Treasure Hunters by Enid Blyton is available in paperback wherever you buy your books.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you would happily reread?
Probably my favourite book that I've ever read is Atonement by Ian McEwan, and I've read it a few times, and I really like it because what it does is it really turns everything on its head. It's got a really amazing twist, and I guess it's about the healing power of fiction. A young girl witnesses something, and she misunderstands what she sees, which gets the couple who are embroiled into big trouble, and she spends the rest of her life trying to atone for it, and ultimately she atones for it in a very unusual but really rather simple but incredibly moving way. And it's if you haven't read or seen the film, which is equally good, unusually for a film, it's well worth reading.
She was one of those children possessed by a desire to have the world just so. Whereas her big sister's room was a stew of unclosed books, unfolded clothes, unmade bed, unemptied ashtrays, Bryony's was a shrine to her controlling demon. The model farm spread across a deep window ledge consisted of the usual animals, but all facing one way, towards their owner, as if about to break into song. And even the farmyard hens were neatly corralled. In fact, Bryony's was the only tidy upstairs room in the house. Her straight-backed dolls in their many-roomed mansion appeared to be under strict instructions not to touch the walls. The various thumb-sized figures to be found standing about her dressing table, cowboys, deep-sea divers, humanoid mice, suggested by their even ranks and spacing, a citizen's army awaiting orders. A taste for the miniature was one aspect of an orderly spirit. Another was a passion for secrets. In a prized, varnished cabinet, a secret drawer was opened by pushing against the grain of a cleverly turned dovetail joint. And here she kept a diary, locked by a clasp, and a notebook written in a code of her own invention. In a toy safe opened by 6 secret numbers, she stored letters and postcards. An old tin petty cash box was hidden under a removable floorboard beneath her bed. In the box were treasures that dated back 4 years to her 9th birthday when she began collecting. A mutant double acorn, fool's gold, a rain-making spell bought at a funfair, a squirrel's skull as light as a leaf. But hidden drawers, lockable diaries and cryptographic systems could not conceal from Bryony the simple truth. She had no secrets. Her wish for a harmonious, organized world denied her the reckless possibilities of wrongdoing. Mayhem and destruction were too chaotic for her tastes, and she did not have it in her to be cruel. Her effective status as an only child, as well as the relative isolation of the Tallis house, kept her, at least during the long summer holidays, from girlish intrigues with friends. Nothing in her life was sufficiently interesting or shameful to merit hiding. No one knew about the squirrel's skull beneath her bed, but no one wanted to know. None of this was particularly an affliction, or rather, it appeared so only in retrospect, once a solution had been found.
Atonement by Ian McEwan is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB13411. It's narrated by Carol Boyd.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a new book, but a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the listeners.
I read a really amazing book called The Long Drop by Denise Miner. I hadn't read any crime books before I wrote A Murder of Crows, so I've been reading a lot of them lately as research as much as anything else, just to see, you know, to try and understand the genre. And Denise Miner's The Long Drop really stood out. She manages to write a lot of things, but with very few words, which is always the mark of a really great writer. And I felt myself transported back to the 50s, which is when the book is set. So I would really recommend that book.
He knows too much to be an honest man, but says he wants to help. He says he can get the gun for them. William Watt is keen to meet him. Lawrence Dowdall has already met Peter Manuel several times. He never wants to see him again. Dowdall parks his beige Bentley on a dark city street and gets out. Watt is waiting on the pavement, next to his maroon Vauxhall Velox. It is early evening in early December. Glasgow is wet and dark, but still warm. The bitterness of winter has yet to bite. Above the roofs, every chimney belches black smoke. Rain drags smut down over the city like a mourning mantilla. Soon, a Clean Air Act will outlaw coal burning in town. 5 square miles of the Victorian city will be ruled unfit for human habitation and torn down, redeveloped in concrete and glass and steel. The population will be moved to the periphery, thinned to a quarter of its current density. 130,000 homes will be demolished in the biggest urban redevelopment project in post-war Europe. Later, the black, bedraggled survivors of this architectural cull will be sandblasted, their hard skins scoured off to reveal glittering yellow and burgundy sandstone. The exposed stone is porous, though. It sucks in rain and splits when it freezes in the winter. But this story is before all of that. This story happens in the old boom city, crowded, Wild West, chaotic.
The Long Drop is out now in print, ebook, and as a commercial audiobook that's narrated by David Monteith.
Once again, Ian, thanks so much for sharing your love of books and reading with the Read On listeners.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Ian Skewis. A Murder of Crows is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library, with a commercial audiobook available on sale online. Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's RedSzell, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.